I'd like to call the Transportation Finance Committee to order.
Kind of rude here.
We don't have a quorum as yet, but today, and we'll temporarily lay the minutes aside too. Today we're going to discuss or have the department, MnDOT, discuss the bridge inspection procedures that they've gone through since the 35W bridge collapse. And we have a welcome to the committee too, I should say. All to the members, it's good to see you. And Mr. Dorgan, I believe you're going to make the presentation?
Correct, Chairman. I'm Dan Dorgan. I'm the bridge engineer for the Minnesota DOT. And also Dwayne's with. Go ahead, Dwayne.
Good morning, Chairman. My name is Dwayne Hill. I'm the assistant district engineer for MnDOT in District 1, which is Duluth. And I'm here along with Dan because Dan asked me to help him with the governor's bridge inspection effort last August after the bridge collapse.
Mr. Hill, if I may just interrupt, all of you do have a handout in your packet. You're aware of that. And Mr. Hill, probably when you get to use the mic, this is recorded too, but probably be a little closer to the mic when you speak.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think we'll go through the information in the PowerPoint, and with the what I'd like to do first is just discuss what our focus is today. What we'd like to do is provide you with just a very brief overview of bridge inspection requirements, because I believe in past hearings you're somewhat familiar with basic requirements of the program, and we hope we've guessed it correctly that the main interest today is actions we've taken in the last year that are related to bridge inspection. And these various actions that we're going to describe kind of reflect items that either we have identified being MnDOT as improvements to our inspection program. At times there are opportunities that were noted in the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report. There was also the Joint Committee report to the House and Senate, along with an independent a review of our inspection program by PB Americas. So that's where the impetus, I guess, came for the various items we're going to share. And again, our goal is to share it with you as a transportation committee. So there's going to be quite a lot of information. Hopefully many of the questions you may have coming in, we'll cover them as we go through the presentation. But we are engineers, so we may use a term at times that isn't understood, so go ahead and please stop us if we need to clarify something that perhaps is confusing to you. And lastly, before I get going too far into this, I'd just like to mention that, as you're well aware, the National Transportation Safety Board hearing on I-35 begins tomorrow in Washington. We'll be carefully, as an agency, looking at those results that the NTSB shares, what their findings are, to determine if there's additional improvements that MnDOT should be making in light of the NTSB's the probable cause that they do find. And we've already taken some steps to date, and one of those we'll be covering as part of this hearing. But I'd encourage you to all look closely at those NTSB results, because as the past 15 months have proceeded, unfortunately at times there's been some premature speculation regarding the I-35W collapse. So I think it's important that you have the definitive information from NTSB. So with that, the brief overview of inspection requirements, I was just going to refer you in your handout, actually in the appendix on the last pages. I think they were pages 27 through 29. We have included a quick summary of inspection requirements, just to let you know. Again, this is probably more a refresher because many of you have heard this before. The governing regulations for inspection come from a variety of sources, starting at the federal level. And that's with the NBIS code, the NBIS standards, and also the codes of federal regulations that Federal Highways produces. So those establish the requirements nationwide, and of course we all have to follow those very closely. So a lot of what our inspectors are doing are dictated by those federal requirements. In addition, ASHTO, or what is known as the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials, these are the 50 states, published a number of documents, one of them being this manual for condition evaluation of bridges. And that, that manual also sets requirements that are then incorporated into the NVIS system. And then finally, there's Minnesota statutes that, again, you may be well aware of, both in statute and in rule, that set requirements within Minnesota that generally make for stricter requirements than the federal requirements. And finally, of course, MnDOT, we have our own technical memorandum. So the inspection frequency then is covered on the next page. There's a requirement nationally that all bridges be inspected every 24 months. In Minnesota, we actually go to a shorter interval when bridges are in condition code 4 or less on that 9-point scale of condition ratings. So, again, that's the case of where we do exceed the federal standards. Fracture-critical bridges, we inspect, get an additional inspection, which is an in-depth inspection, once every 24 months. And then there are also underwater inspections that are conducted periodically on bridges. And lastly, what I just want to mention on these requirements, and again, I'm going through these quickly because I sense that it's probably not so much the subject today of interest to us all, but bridge inspector qualifications. Within MnDOT, we have 75 certified inspection team leaders that meet the state and federal requirements, and I just want to emphasize that there's strict requirements for what it takes to be a team leader, and a team leader has to be present in every inspection, and Duane happens to be one of those team leaders. One needs either a professional license or 5 years experience. There's extensive training one has to go through, a proficiency exam, which is a Minnesota requirement that's in addition to the federal requirements, and then there's requirements to attend refresher training, which amounts to continuing education, and we'll be talking about that a little later as we go through that. So with that, again, that's that. What I tried to make is a brief overview of requirements, and as Chairman Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Dorgan. There are two things. In that appendix, was that the existing number of people that you had, or is that since this 35W bridge? And is this existing procedures that you had, or is this also since that you changed since the 35W bridge?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the 75 inspectors were where we were last fall, so that would have been at the time of collapse. I think we're actually, my recollection, we might be up to 78 at this time. So that was, 75 is pretty much the number before the collapse and after the collapse. Now the requirements have not changed nationally for inspections, and I think we shall see, you know, dependent on the NTSB results over the next few days, there may be some changes coming nationally, but there are not changes nationally. What we are doing in Minnesota, though, we'll be covering that as we go through this PowerPoint.
One other thing for the benefit of the committee, we're talking about fracture critical. Maybe you should just identify the other classifications so they can be aware of it, if you would, Mr. Dorgan.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, all of our bridges receive inspection either once every 2 years or every year, depending if again if their condition rating has fallen to 4, and we call those the routine inspections that every bridge in the state would receive. Not only us, but the counties and cities would be inspecting their own. In addition, there are fracture critical bridges. There are roughly about 200 within the state. MnDOT itself owns about 71 fracture critical bridges. So those get an additional inspection, which we call an in-depth inspection, which means for every element of the bridge that is designated as a fracture critical member, subject which would be subject to the possibility of a fatigue type crack, those receive an in-depth inspection where the inspector has to get within an arm's length as they go over that member. So those inspections are generally once every 24 months. If that covers your question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dorgan, I guess, too, that other than the fracture critical, I think you have a split as far as there aren't, a bridge, this is not fracture critical by its own nature. It's because something happened to it, and something's happened to the other bridge. So you really, you have your fracture critical, and you just have critical bridges, or whatever you want to call them, right? I mean, fracture critical is really the most deteriorated one, or one in need of replacement or repair, basically. That's what I'd like to say, basically.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the fracture critical bridges are actually a specific type of bridge. So the types of bridges that are fracture critical are generally trusses. Also bridges that only are supported by two girders would be a fracture critical bridge. And what it means, if they're fracture critical, they are what we call non-redundant. And that's an engineering term, but that there are not alternate load paths in the bridge. The vast majority of our bridges, if you drive around the freeways and look up, you'll see multiple lines of beams supporting those bridges. So none of those are fracture critical, because there's multiple supports there for the deck that you're driving on. But a fracture critical is a certain type of bridge, meaning that it is non-redundant.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get out, so I think that's okay. Correct. Mr. Hill was going to proceed, or were you, Mr. Dorgan?
I'm going to run through the first couple of slides, and then I will be turning it over to Dwayne. As I mentioned, one of the items we are going to cover today that's related to inspections directly involves the NTSB findings. If you recall, in January, NTSB released information along with Federal Highways regarding some of their preliminary information on I-35, citing a design error in the gusset plate. Because we were a party to the investigation and have been supplying information to NTSB, we were aware of this issue and had actually begun working on it in fall of 07. There really was no methods existing, no software existed to check gusset plates, and the rating methods, there really wasn't a well-defined rating method on gussets. So our first steps through the fall, through October and November, were to develop our own system for checking gusset plates. And so we had already begun that when the January announcement came out from NTSB. And I'd just like to point out, the photo on the right is the Hastings Bridge. And I think actually on the monitors you can probably see it better. If you look just above where the chains are on the photo, there's a new piece of steel added into that bridge. That was part of our repairs this spring. And this relates to a term I'll be using on one of the later slides. That is a brace in there that's bracing the two gussets to sandwich the members. And the purpose of that that brace is to reduce that unsupported length of that gusset plate, which when we reviewed Hastings, we found that those braces should have been in the bridge when it was built originally. So that was one of the corrections made as we went through these reviews. So with that, the gusset plate reviews, and I know you've heard news about these as we were doing them. By July 1st of this year of 08, we had all 25 trusses on the MnDOT system. We had completed the engineering reviews, rated the entire bridge, and specifically looked at the gusset plate to verify the original design. That was the requirement. Actually, NTSB and Federal Highways recommended that owners do this for all bridges, that since the bridge was built, there either been a change of condition or one had added load to. In our case, we just decided to do all 25 trusses that we own, regardless of whether there had been a change of condition or not. So we went through the engineering reviews, and then by August 1st, we also followed that up by field reviews to check if there was any corrosion or deterioration of the gussets. The results of those reviews, there was no deficiencies found that were similar to I-35W in the design of the original gussets. So there are no similar situations to I-35. The photo, by the way, on the right there is of the Wabasha Bridge over the Mississippi at Wabasha, Minnesota. So this is a truss and a fracture critical bridge.
Excuse me, Mr. Dorgan, yes, Representative Jefferson.
Just a quick question then. Does that mean that of the bridges that you looked at, if in the design there was a certain thickness of gusset plate identified, you checked to make sure that thickness was the one that was actually installed, And also that you looked at the design to see whether the right thickness was prescribed?
Yes, that would be correct. We had both confirmed that the original design was correct, so the plates were the correct thickness. We followed that through on the shop drawings and in the field to confirm that what was supplied was the correct plate also. So the results of those reviews, while we did not find any deficiencies, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, is there another question?
Representative, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Jordan. Just a follow-up to Representative Hartman's question. As part of that same analysis and examination from initial design through shop drawings, through construction, and actually in the field, is also increased loading, was that an additional variable considered for each of these 25 bridges?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes, additional loading was considered and also corrosion, if there had been any corrosion in the gussets since the bridge was built, too. So both those factors were taken into account as we went through determining, you know, our first step was to confirm the original design was correct, but then also to confirm that based on any changes over the years, there were still the proper safety factors in that gusset.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, to make sure that that we're all on the same page. When you say additional loading, is my fault, or not specifying additional traffic volume as well as any additional surface material that might have happened from overlays and repavement and that sort.
Right. The main concern is additional dead load that's added as far as additional material. Most of these were designed in an era where the traffic loading, that they would have been designed similar to today. So the fact that they might have originally carried 2,000 cars a day and are now carrying 10,000 really does not really change the loading requirements on the bridge.
Thank you.
Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, then as I mentioned, the original designs were confirmed, but there were issues that were found out there as we did the field inspection. I think, well aware of these from the different the actions we took last spring. The St. Cloud Bridge, which had been scheduled for replacement, we had found that there was some gusset plates that were slightly bent on there. We did close the bridge. It was later attributed to the original erection of the bridge. But our decision was to accelerate the replacement, and that's underway already up at St. Cloud. And that bridge will be completed about a year from now. The Blatnik Bridge in Duluth, and this was, and gets to one of the previous questions, additional load had been added to that bridge in the early 90s. And we found that the gussets then needed to be stiffened to get back to the full safety factor for that bridge. In fact, the photo that you see down on the right is a photo from one of the gussets on the Blatnik Bridge, and perhaps you can make it out, but on the right side of that photo is some additional steel that you'll see on the surface of that gusset. That is the steel that was added in June to brace this and take care of that issue. So those revisions were made to the Blatnik Bridge. Another item I'll just point out while we're on that photo, you have to have really good eyes looking at your copy there, but you may be able to see there are some small the numbers written various places on that gusset plate along with a plus mark. That's the target where the inspection staff did ultrasonic thickness measurements to confirm the thickness of those gussets and that we had not to determine if any had been lost due to corrosion. So that was some of the testing that was going on as they did these field inspections. So that was Blatnik. Winona Bridge, we did have corrosion. We had corrosion on Winona Bridge, so there was corrections made to Winona. And then the Hastings Bridge, again, I talked about that earlier photo where the main issue there was just that unsupported length of the gusset that should have been stiffened, so we brought it up to code. So in summary then on those gusset plates, we confirmed the original designs were correct in the other 25 bridges, and the repairs have been made. And I think that'll be some of the subjects we hear over the next couple of days from NTSB, and that not only meets, but goes beyond what was recommended in January. So turning then from the gusset plate And getting to some of the recommendations that were made over the course of the last year, legislative auditor had recommended that MnDOT increase our staffing for fracture critical inspections. So the department has done that. We've established 8 additional positions, and those are split. 6 of those are in the bridge office, and our District 6 Rochester and Metro each has 1 position also. To date, we've filled 3 of the 6 within the bridge office, and we're advertising for the additional engineering positions. And I'm sorry, I meant to call Rochester and Metro to confirm where they are at, but I know they're in the process of filling their positions also. So we're expanding our fracture critical staff because I think that need that the auditor cited was well placed. With that, I'll turn it over to Duane, who's going to cover some of the slides for us.
Thank you, Mr. Hill.
All right. The Governor's Inspection Program. On August 2nd last year, 2007, he gave a directive to inspect all the bridges in Minnesota. In the reaction by the engineering community was what is shown here on the slide. The first thing we did was we looked at all the deck truss bridges, and that's not shown on the slide, but within the couple of days after the collapse, we inspected all of our deck truss bridges, not knowing the cause of the collapse of the 35W bridge. But deck truss bridge type was the type of bridge that had failed, so that was the first thing that MnDOT did, was we inspected those bridges. But we interpreted what the governor said doing an in-depth inspection of all the fracture critical bridges, whether they were on the state highway system or the local highway system. We did a routine inspection on all of our state and local structurally deficient bridges, either performed by MnDOT inspectors or county or city inspectors. We also did routine inspections on all of our trunk highway bridges, which is above and beyond what our normal inspection cycle would be. And lastly, we hired an independent consultant to do what the governor termed a stem-to-stern review of our bridge inspection program. So part of my job during that inspection process was to help communicate what our progress was. And so daily we did an update how many bridges were inspected. We had a running tally until we were done with all of them. So on December 20th of 2007, we were able to report that we had inspected all 3,875 trunk highway bridges by doing either a routine inspection or an in-depth within arm's reach fracture critical inspection on the fracture critical bridges. And of those inspections, about 270 of those were performed by consultants to supplement our MnDOT inspection forces. On the local system, there were 141 fracture critical bridges that were inspected by either MnDOT personnel or consultants. 43 of those fracture critical bridges were inspected by our consultants. And then also on the local system, there were 843 structurally deficient bridges that were inspected by the county and city inspectors. So one thing as we were going through that process, what does it all mean, is really what I was trying to figure out. How do I tell that story? And the one thing that we have a process that we call critical finding process, where if something really serious during a bridge inspection is identified, it's reported to the bridge office. And during that period of time, we had 17 critical findings. And the result of those critical findings were that 6 bridges were closed. They're listed on the slide, and they're all on the local highway system. There were 6 bridges that we had to do some review, and we changed the bridge posting, or either changed the bridge posting or did lane or load restrictions. And some of those restrictions included height restrictors so that tall vehicles couldn't get on the bridge. On really low volume local roads. And then lastly, we had 5 bridges that were repaired, and 2 of those were on our state trunk highway system. One of them was the Highway 11 bridge over the Red River north in Kitson County, and it was closed briefly while we did a repair on an element. And then also on Highway 10 near Little Falls, we closed a ramp off of Highway 10 briefly while we did a repair on a beam that was damaged by a high load hit. The stem to stern review that the governor asked us to do, we had a hired TB Americas, which is a national company that does the engineering work, to help us with our bridge inspection. And we coupled onto that contract a review of our bridge inspection program. So in that review, we asked them to look at MnDOT's bridge inspection program and compare what we do to the national bridge inspection standards that Dan talked about earlier. And if you go into the Code of Federal Regulations for the National Bridge Inspection Standards, there's 5 major titles or subject areas in the standards. So we had the consultant look at our program in relationship to those 5 subject areas. So one of them is the organization of how you get your bridge inspections done. The next one is qualifications of personnel. The next one is, did you get your inspections done on time, the frequency part of inspections? What are the procedures that you use? And then lastly, the inventory of bridges, all the data that's collected by MnDOT for the whole state and submitted to Federal Highway Administration at the end of the year. And what the consultant found was, basically, MnDOT was in compliance with these standards. One of the most interesting and in-depth things that they did was the consultant had inspected about 310 plus or minus bridges on the trunk highway and the local system. And they compared the results that their inspectors got, there weren't a lot of consultant bridge inspectors that worked in Minnesota, so typically they had worked in other states. But they compared those consultant inspection results with the previous results that were collected by either the MnDOT or the county or the city bridge inspectors. And so it was a very, very large quality control sample to compare. And they found that they were very, very, very close as far as the results, our inspectors versus the consultant inspectors. So that was probably the best vote of confidence for MnDOT from this process, was to compare those actual inspection ratings between the consultant inspectors and the MnDOT local, county, or city inspectors. They were very similar. Of course, they did have recommendations, and their report was it followed the legislative auditor report and a couple of other reports that had a review of our bridge inspection program. The recommendations are shown on the slide. The first one was to look at procedures to track maintenance action items that resulted from bridge inspection findings, and basically do a better job of documenting what our action steps are after we do our bridge inspections. Another one was to provide more inspection training for the program administrators, and those are the engineers that oversee the bridge inspection programs in the MnDOT districts or the each county or city. Another recommendation was to hire more fracture critical bridge inspectors for the bridge office. The bridge office provides that service for all the MnDOT bridges and the local system of bridges. They're supplemented by fracture critical inspection crews in our metro district and in our Rochester district. But overall, the consultant felt like we needed to add more staff to be able to meet the newer 2-year inspection frequency requirement for fracture critical inspections. Another one was to develop and document inspection procedures for complex bridges. and their examples of complex bridges were cable supported bridges and concrete segmental box girder bridges, things that required a few more extra steps for the inspection process. And something that MnDOT did not have documented procedures developed for. Another recommendation was ensure that our inspection data is entered into our database that we submit to Federal Highway within the 3-month interval from when the inspection is completed. Another one is to clarify responsibilities between MnDOT fracture critical inspectors and the local agency inspectors. And this recommendation stems out of the idea that MnDOT fracture critical inspection crews had been inspecting bridges for the counties and cities for years. And we inspected the fracture critical elements of the bridge, but there were not good coordination between entering the data produced in the MnDOT fracture critical report and the local routine inspection report. And then the last inspection recommendation they had was developing standardized narrative bridge inspection reports. And that was something that the consultant actually started for us because they wrote numerous bridge inspection reports for us during the contract that we had with them. So as a result of these recommendations and recommendation by the legislative auditor, we immediately started working on developing a standard procedure to document our post-bridge inspection maintenance activities. And our first step was to develop and distribute a bridge inspection maintenance assessment form. And that form was actually developed by our metro district, but we've implemented across MnDOT wide this inspection season. And the purpose of that is to help better document scheduled maintenance actions or maintenance actions that need to be scheduled, and also to document the decision process, whether what actually action steps are taken by the item that's identified during the bridge inspection. And then the second part of that, this December, we're expecting to have a standard spreadsheet developed and distributed across all the MnDOT districts that will help us track the completion of all these maintenance actions so that we can summarize that at the end of the year and show what percentage of those were completed and also have the checklist of ones that were not completed so we know what we need to follow up with. Another one of the outcomes of this whole process were looking at our fracture critical inspection quality assurance and quality control process. One of the things that we implemented with the consultant was we wanted them, because they were working independently in the field, we wanted them to let us know when they completed each inspection. And we asked them to put together a brief email back that could be distributed to the bridge owner, whether it was MnDOT or a county or a city, and myself trying to manage this consultant project, that stated the bridge inspection was completed and what day it was completed, and then if there were any findings that they thought we immediately needed to know about. And that way we were able to step in and address those findings as soon as possible if there were serious things that needed to be addressed. So the types of things that we're trying to, in this process we've implemented into our fracture critical process for this year and will be for the following years. And what we're trying to do is identify significant deficiencies that were noted by the inspectors, a need for a new load rating. If there were traffic or other safety hazards present, we want to know about those right away. A brief summary of the bridge element conditions. Did they stay the same as the previous inspection? Did they get worse? Did they get better because there was some maintenance activity? And then were there significant findings that need further review or follow-up in the next 6-month interval? The purpose of this whole process is to identify deficiencies that require immediate action before the in-depth report's written. And there's usually quite a time period between when the field inspection work gets completed, and a written report is developed, reviewed, and distributed to the bridge owner. Dan mentioned critical findings. If we had identified critical findings during our inspection process, our procedure is to follow up with those immediately that day. So those things would be addressed immediately. There's one other thing that we did in the fracture critical inspection area in quality assurance or quality control. And that is relating back to one of the recommendations from the consultant, which is clarify the roles of the inspectors on local bridge inspections, fracture critical bridge inspections. And in the past, we had written these narrative fracture critical bridge inspection reports and mailed them to the county engineer or the city engineer or the district in the case if the bridge was a trunk highway bridge. But there was not two-way communication that indicated whether the owner read the report or followed up with any recommendations or identified action items from that report. So we implemented a process beginning a year ago where we reviewed the report and developed recommendations and provided a transmittal letter along with that report with, if necessary, action steps for the bridge owner. Mm-hmm. And we also implemented, during that process, a structured review of the report internally before it's distributed. So the questions for the reviewer are, were critical findings resolved promptly? Are the conclusions from the report logically stated and correct? Is the structure functioning as designed? Should the load rating be reevaluated? So as we develop this transmittal letter, we consider those things. We transmit the report to the bridge owner, and we ask them to acknowledge receipt. And that's the big change as far as a quality control step. That's a big one, I think, that we took in closing the loop with both bridge owners in making sure that they've received the letter and the report, thoroughly read and understand it, and follow up as necessary.
Excuse me. I see we have Senator Murphy, and nice to have you. If you want to come up in front, Senator Murphy, that's fine. If you got any pertinent questions, you can raise your hand. Yeah, thank you. Mr. Dorgan?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we'd welcome the chance to go to the Senate Transportation Committee and give the same presentation, too. So, Dwayne had just finished covering the quality assurance process on fracture critical. I'm going to turn back to what we call the routine inspection and our what's really a long-standing quality assurance process with those. One thing I should mention, some of this is in response to the legislative auditor report, but also the joint committee report to the House and Senate mentioned quality assurance, quality control as an area of where improvements could be made. So we're in the process of condensing all these procedures into a single document for convenience. But then turning to a routine inspection.
Excuse me. Before you start, we have a question. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe before we leave this documentation portion of the presentation, I have a question about, you know, moving. You have some procedures now that you're establishing in place moving forward. But what about some of the problems that were documented in the past where, you know, you just had almost, you know, a lack of kind of written records of some of these inspections, you know, on all these fracture critical bridges? I mean, has anything been done to correct that? You know, can one now look at, you know, written documentation about some of the previous inspections over, you know, periods of time, 5, 10, 15, 20 years? As I recall, that was one of the concerns that was raised in the Gray Plant Moody report.
Okay. Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortenstein, I think what was raised in the Gray Plant Moody report, my recollection, there was not a question that the inspections were done and that the reports
right.
existed, but there was reference to an oral culture.
Correct.
Where the often, and it's because our people are working closely together, and sometimes inspection personnel and maintenance personnel are in the same unit. So when things were found in inspection findings, often the procedures varied between districts how those were followed up. At times it was verbally telling a bridge crew to go fix something, and then I think what was cited was there was a lack of a record of when it was done or when it was followed up. You know, that's not to say things weren't followed up, but I think it's we fell into the sort of the familiarity of working with each other every day, and things at times were oral. Other districts, though, had good records of how they would sit, go over their inspection reports, and then that would give them a list of maintenance items to follow up on the next season. But it varied. So the in answer then to your question, I think part of what Dwayne had covered, and that was back on a few slides earlier, this was documenting the post-inspection bridge maintenance decisions. That was slide number 14. We are trying to directly address that issue. And it was cited both by the auditor and, as you noted, the Joint Committee report also cited that same issue. So does that answer your question?
Well, there's some procedures that are being put in place now, but you know, is there a way to, if one were to try to access the history or process that was used, you know, up until this point in some of these inspections, I'm getting at that oral culture, is there yet a way to find that, to go back and, you know, look at documents so that, you know, we can get that entire history, because, you know, some actions were taken, Winona and others, and that's a good thing. But I'm still concerned that we don't have, you know, I think a whole process set up to find out those, you know, what was lacking in that oral culture, as you point out.
Okay. Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, I think if we were to go in past years, the records would vary, you know, admittedly there. We do have records, we do have maintenance records, though, when actions are completed in the field. So they will record time as maybe having worked on a joint on a bridge. What isn't there always is the tie that says this was a result of the 1997 inspection report that said to work on joint 12. And you know, you can't directly relate it, but the work was done, and there's a record of maintenance and a citing and inspection report, but they aren't directly tied together. So the process that Dwayne described, I think again it was, I believe slide 14 covered it, was in the future those records will be there that will address from the inspection report what the reviewer found as items that needed to be addressed, and if items were not addressed, what was the logic for not having addressed that? Because at times an inspector may cite something that the engineer will look at and state that it is not an issue that requires addressing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll, I think, continue to monitor and follow up on this.
Okay. Mr. Dorgan?
Okay. Thank you. So turning to routine inspections then, and this, again, is a longstanding practice, whether it's MnDOT, a county, or a city, when inspections are finished, those are required to be reviewed and signed off on by the program administrator, who is a registered engineer. So that's part of the QA process that was already in place. In addition to that, there are annual audits conducted of our inspection program by MnDOT and Federal Highways, and that's for checking for compliance with the National Bridge Inspection Standards. What we do is every year, and this is again a long-standing process, and it's been going on for many years, we select about 20 or 25 counties, cities, and districts throughout the state. We audit their records, and then we, from that group, we select 8 to 12 where we actually go out and visit the agency and go through their inspection reports, audit their procedures, the qualifications of their staff, their files, whether documentation is complete, and also do a field inspection of at least one of the bridges in their district to compare, their district or county, to compare to our ratings by our inspection staff. So that audit process is long-standing and has been ongoing. And the next slide shows you a map of what we do is we just more for convenience for travel and to cut down the travel for our people. We rotate different regions of the state. So this shows from 2006 out to 2010 the regions of the state where we're conducting those audits. And as you can see, in 2008, this year the audits are being done up in the northwest section of the state. And what's listed there on the right then are the counties, cities, or districts that were audited. Actually, what's missing here is there was also five cities that were looked at within that, in 2007, within that south west corner of the state. I know Willmar and Hutchinson were part of that, and sorry, I forget the other three cities that were part of that audit process. But that, again, is a long-standing process and part of our quality assurance that is conducted on the inspection program statewide. In addition, and I'm not sure that that's on a later slide, Federal Highways does conduct an annual audit of MnDOT's inspection program itself, too. This is an audit of all the agencies that conduct the inspections that I just described. We've also implemented within the last year a tracking process for completion of inspections. And this was something that was written up in the legislative auditor's report. They discussed that they said inspections were getting done. At times, they were looking at the compliance with a strict 24-month cycle. And they noted that, I think the percentages there were 86% were getting done within the 24 months, 97% were getting done within the 24 months plus the 90-day grace period that was allowed to get the inspections completed. All were getting done, but it was compliance with that strict 24-month cycle wasn't always being achieved. So we've begun tracking that, reporting quarterly to our district of the number of inspections that we find from our records are either overdue or not entered in the system. And that doesn't mean the inspections haven't been done, but at times what's happening is inspectors are completing a number of inspections and not entering the data because they're still busy out in the field finishing more inspections. So we're trying to get those on a more regular basis, and obviously our goal is to achieve 100%, but we've had good compliance in the past, and we're trying to make that improve that as we go.
Mr. Dorgan, excuse us. Representative Beard.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dorgan, on slide 19, just refresh my memory what FONTIS is. What is that acronym stand for?
FONTIS, it's a Latin word for Ponce's Bridge, so it's a database system where and thanks for asking the question. When inspections are completed statewide by counties, cities, MnDOT districts, they're reported into that database, and that database is maintained by MnDOT. And that's how we're able to track records, track condition. We also annually have to report that to Federal Highways. So this is a system that gathers it for the entire state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for asking. As part of our inspection program also, we have training every year, and this is just a list of the training that is scheduled for 2009. We have refresher training that is held. We actually hold those multiple locations statewide for not only our own staff, but for counties, cities, and consultants that at times do inspections for local government. And I just included, I know the very back page of your PowerPoint, I didn't intend to spend a lot of time on it, but just wanted to give you a list of, it's page 30, the topics that were covered as part of this refresher training in 2008 and what we're currently planning on conducting in 2009. And those are generally conducted in February when prior to the inspection season. So typically we go over any changes that are might have been coming from NBIS or our own requirements, and certainly obviously the I-35 bridge will continue to be any learnings from that will continue to be an item for this refresher training. So if you're a certified inspector, you're required to go to this refresher training to maintain your certification. So it's like continuing education in other professions. So that's the refresher training, and we've been doing that for at least a decade or so. Every year we also schedule some bridge safety classes, training new inspectors so that we can maintain a good system of qualified inspectors. And so if one wanted to be an inspector, one would need to take both the bridge safety class 1 and 2 if you're along with the 5 years in experience if you're not an engineer. If you're an engineer, you still need to take the 2-week training class to become a certified inspector and also pass that proficiency training that I mentioned. We also have a fracture critical inspection class, and by the way, all these classes meet federal highways requirements, and they're actually conducted by the National Highway Institute, which is funded by federal highways. So they are classes that are used nationally. So it's particularly timely to have that class back in Minnesota this spring, since we are staffing up on fracture critical inspection staff. So that's the ongoing training that we conduct. And we have, in February, updated two of our technical memorandums on inspections, and those are on the MnDOT website. One of them deals with critical deficiencies. Duane mentioned this earlier. The definition of a critical deficiency is a situation if your inspector out in the field and you see an item that you believe threatens the safety of the bridge, obviously we want to take immediate action. So we have a rigorous process set up to address critical deficiencies, and of course it's in real time. You address them right that day. And Duane mentioned some of the critical deficiencies that were found in the inspections last year. One of those that you may be familiar with was that trunk highway bridge that was mentioned on Highway 11 over the Red River, where it was closed right that afternoon, and then repairs were made over the weekend before we reopened it. So there's sort of a hierarchy, and obviously things that one believes threaten the safety of the bridge need to be dealt with immediately, whereas something that would be good maintenance to follow up on, those would be covered in that normal QA process and then eventually become part of the work program. So we updated critical deficiencies. We also updated our guidelines for fracture critical inspections. And a lot of this was driven by the changes to the National Bridge Inspection System that came out in the last several years. So that lays out, reiterates the frequency, the inspector qualifications, and the quality assurance for fracture critical inspection. And I'm getting near the end, so we'll, in case you're wondering here, we did want to cover some of the additional inspection equipment or technologies we're exploring, and kind of closing off with that. We have purchased additional ultrasonic equipment, and that's due to our expanded fracture critical staff, so we want to have them fully equipped as they come on board. In addition to the ultrasonic, there's another tool that's used that's called magnetic particles. So both of those, the ultrasonic testing equipment can be, various forms of it can be used to do measurements of thickness of plates, so you're checking for corrosion. Can also be used to detect cracks, and along with the magnetic particle testing. So it's technology we've been using for years. As the second bullet notes, though, there have been some updates to that testing equipment, so obviously what we've ordered is the latest equipment that we'll be receiving for our inspection staff. We're also going to be contracting for some ground penetrating radar. What that is a mobile unit, a fairly expensive unit, but we're going to have some selected bridge decks checked using this radar system, and we're checking for delamination in concrete in the decks that you can that can be detected from the surface. So that contract will be, I'm sorry I haven't kept up if that's already underway. If not, it'll be early in 2009 that will be going. We're also reviewing software, and Duane was part of this review of software. These are really automation devices that would help our inspection staff in the field. with fuel data collection units. And the photo on the right shows was taken from one of the bridge. We sent two inspectors, or Duane and an inspector, to another state to review some of the technology they were looking at. And this is, you know, our goal here is to automate, further automate the inspections, and to have data in the field that would be very useful to an inspector, like an automated device where they'd be able to pull up a photo from last year's inspection or from inspection 5 years ago. If they're looking at a particular detail, wondering if it's changed, more than just having a narrative from a past inspection report and try to look at it visually and decide, does the narrative tell me it's changed? They'd have the actual photo to look at. I think I hope I've captured that correctly, Duane. That'd be an example of one of the promise of this type of technology, along with the past inspection report. So we're looking at that, and there's actually a number of systems that we've asked vendors to send us information on. We're ordering additional inspection equipment because of the expanded staff, additional what we call the snooper vehicles. You've seen some of the presentation earlier showed the photos of the big arm coming off the truck with a bucket. That's a snooper vehicle. And also a trailer-mounted inspection platform for smaller bridges where the load capacity of the bridge is such that we can't put the snooper vehicle on, because those are fairly heavy trucks. So at times, some of our older bridges that are posted, particularly on the local system, we can't bring all that heavy equipment on, so we needed a more lightweight mobile system for that. So that's just an idea to give you a little flavor of some of the equipment or technology we're pursuing. Yes, Representative
Mr. Dorgan, in that picture, that's a concrete box scooter inside?
And that is.
How do you inspect that with your ground penetrator? How did you inspect it prior to this time? You didn't, because...
Well... Go ahead, do you want to cover that?
Well, the inspections are visual. On this particular box girder, it was in a different state. They had done quite a bit of... It's got tension ducts in the girders where they tension cables, and they did quite a bit of work to identify the location of those ducts and look for voids in them. And they had gone through and mapped all of those ducts using it was a technology that relied on sound waves. And there, inside that box girder, there were steel shot all over the bottom of the floor, because they would shoot the steel shot off of the inside of the concrete and have devices that would listen for the sound waves and how they transmitted through the concrete. So they're possible, you know, when you know you have a problem with a particular bridge, there's a possible additional technology that you could apply to further identify the problem. So once they found these voids, then they were able to go in and drill and grout and fill the void areas in the tensioning ducts. But this particular inspection that we attended, it was visual, and they were mapping the cracks actually on CAD drawings with a laptop computer, and they had photographs of those from year to year, so you could see how the crack propagated or didn't propagate. And the Dan's discussion about ground penetrating radar, the advantage of that is we can determine if there's delamination or bridge decks at traffic speeds or almost traffic speeds, so we don't have to set up lane closures and chain drag the deck and listen for delamination. And particularly in the metro area, that's a really difficult thing to do. So for the bridges in this area, the ground penetrating radar is a really nice technology to help us determine the condition of our decks without affecting traffic.
And as long as we're on the subject of delamination, I'd like to address an issue, and this is related to an incident that occurred last July with the Maryland Bridge, where you probably recall we had concrete that had fallen off a bridge one Saturday evening and struck a car. I just want to say, in the past, our bridge crews have routinely throughout the districts removed loose concrete, or when they have seen it, In the case of Maryland, it was not caught, and that certainly is a situation that should not have occurred. And because of that, we've sent out reminders to our districts, guidance. There's a series of dates showing there where we've asked our districts to pay special attention to that issue. They are prioritizing their bridges based on conditions, so those bridge decks that are known to be of some deterioration or aged, they're looking at first, and a lot of that work has already been completed. So this was as of over a week ago. Districts reported back their completions on that work and that they've removed some spalls from at least 18 bridges across the state. So again, the Maryland Avenue incident is something that should not have occurred, and we're trying to take the steps to make sure it does not happen again.
Mr. Dorgan, Ripton, Kayla.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Dorgan, is in addition to spalling from horizontal surfaces on the underside, we also have a few bridges. I know the North Branch Bridge, which will be up for another few years. The re-rod is actually showing on the side barriers. And have you also set up procedures to look at, you know, from these shorter vertical surfaces that a contact or an accident could essentially spall off? And
okay, Mr. Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kalin, the North Branch Bridge, I'm not sure the exact date. I think that's the late 60s, early 70s vintage, I would guess, when that interstate was built in that section. As you mentioned, it's set for replacement soon. And sorry, I can't recall the letting date. But on a bridge such as that, we have a couple choices. We do at times remove that loose concrete and then recast the concrete over it. I think given that bridge is nearing replacement, we're probably deferring maintenance on that for the replacement. The actual strength of the railing, though, is maintained. The purpose of that concrete cover is to protect the rebar, and given the fact that replacement's coming soon, is probably the reason the maintenance crew, I would guess, is not addressing it in that instance. But other times we do, if the bridge is going to stay in service, and we intend to either replace that rail or go in and remove it and patch it.
And just a quick follow-up, Representative Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Jordan, do you have a sense of how many other bridges, we have a lot of bridges that are of that same vintage around the state that are just simple overpasses and just post and beam construction, essentially. Do you have a sense of how many others have severe corrosion and disappearance, for lack of a better term, of those side rails and the guard rails? Is this a problem that exists around the state or only in a couple of small handful of bridges?
Representative Kalin, Mr. Chairman, sorry, off the top of my head, I can't give you the count. There are, at times we see this is, you know, part of the deterioration of a structure sitting out there in Minnesota's climate. The exact count I can't give you. That is probably something we could look up out of the database on rail conditions.
Sure.
I think we could use our Pontus system to try to find that exact number if that's of interest to you. But we do address it, particularly through two routes, either removing it and patching or replacing the entire rail at times.
Just one last thought, Mr. Chair. Just thinking about, you know...
Oh, Representative Kalin, I thought you were finished.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Just looking, you know, wanting to avoid the concrete falling off onto traffic below, if you could just report back to us or to me personally in some way, just kind of how should people be concerned at all about the guardrails as well as the spalling, and if not, why not, and if so, what are we doing to make sure that that's part of the same general inspection and maintenance related to the spalling issue? Thanks.
Okay. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the Maryland Avenue Bridge, you said it should not have happened. I'm curious, what should have happened to catch it and didn't? Or what should have happened and didn't?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, as part of our inspections, and our districts routinely, when they see loose concrete on bridges, they schedule that for removal. And so that's the action that should have been taken on Maryland. It should have been spotted earlier, and it should have been removed. So it did not. It was not done. So that's why I state that is a situation that should not have occurred, and we're trying to, and that is why we've reminded all our districts to pay special attention to that. And Dwayne, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add as one that manages a district system.
No, that's an expectation for my bridge inspectors and bridge maintenance personnel to address those when they identify them as possible. So.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and gentlemen, was there any formal disciplinary action taken by any employees? Was anybody held responsible for that oversight?
Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, I'm not aware of any disciplinary action that was taken. There was noted some deterioration in the deck. I think from the past inspections, as they looked at it, they did not see the severity of it. So I think one of the things we've asked our districts to do too is reminded that at times you can't just look at these from down below. At times when you see something, you've got to close down a lane and get access and get up closer to look at it. So, but there has not been any type of disciplinary action taken, though.
Thank you.
Mr. Dorgan, in relation to that, what was this falling? Was it part of the curb, or was it the deck, or the rail, or what? I mean, normally that would make a difference if they get at it right away, too, wouldn't it?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, what spalled was the Maryland Bridge has its multiple steel beams, and it was the underside of the deck between those beams where it was the approximately the inch and a quarter of concrete that's between the bottom of the deck and the first layer of reinforcing steel. So that was the concrete. There was some corrosion in the steel, and as it expands, it pops off the concrete. That deck was its original, I think, about mid-1960s bridge deck in that portion of the bridge. And it is scheduled for replacement, Maryland.
Mr. Dorgan or Mr. Hill? Or do you have a question?
I think Representative Hausman.
Representative Hausman, oh.
Yes. Just to follow up on Representative Holbrook's question, just recently the personnel issue in the department, there could be no follow-up because they noted there hadn't really been, the supervisors had signed off on the work, and so they couldn't hold the employees responsible, as I understand reading from the newspaper account. And, I mean, this is, of course, an incredible set of principles and procedures that you've put in place, but in a sense, it all ultimately depends on supervision of this whole network of people. And so I guess that's the one question I have. This assumes a huge amount of oversight. And then I might add a related question. I don't see it addressed here, but clearly everything they've talked about has a huge cost that we have, and this is all new. These are new positions. And in our previous hearing, I think the department was clear that we perhaps haven't given them sufficient funding yet for everything that needs to be done. So my question is, as I understand, you said, our first priority is safety, our second priority is maintenance, and third is expansion. The two bridges that I wonder about are Cayuga and Stillwater Bridge. Has there been a rethinking? My understanding is, have I got the right bridge? Cayuga is going to be, that's expansion, five lanes in each direction, which would be a very, very expensive project, I would assume. And then the Stillwater Bridge, and we know something about that increasing cost. If they don't fix that safety piece, are we rethinking where those two bridges are in the flow of work?
Okay. Mr. Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, regarding Cayuga and Stillwater, and I'm working from memory now, and I'll take Cayuga first. I can't remember if it's five lanes, but it's definitely expansion, because I think the freeway from downtown St. Paul up to at least Maryland will have some expansion through that area. That is scheduled for either 2013 or 2014, I'm sorry I can't recall the exact year. The program is continually looked at, but Cayuga is not a fracture critical bridge. It's a multi-girder bridge. Our main element deteriorating there is the deck. It happens to be over a railroad yard area under Cayuga. So the bridge is certainly safe for service, but the deck is deteriorating, and so we want to replace the entire bridge. And so that is upcoming, along with, actually it would be more than just the bridge itself. There's a major reconstruction through that area at the time. So I think that project meets both an expansion and, I would call it, a preservation or safety goal. The bridges need replacement, and while we're in there doing that, we will handle the expansion needs at the same time. St. Croix is also scheduled for replacement, and a lot of that is enabled by the funding that was received last year, the transportation funding, earlier this spring. So Stillwater is scheduled in a similar time frame. That's when both Wisconsin and Minnesota will have the funds from the transportation funding to replace it. In the meantime, we have we've certainly thoroughly gone through the Stillwater Bridge, and it is posted as it has been posted for a while for load restrictions on that structure. I'm not sure if I've answered. Representative Houston, have I answered?
Get at the cost of everything you've talked about today, which has to be enormous. And we clearly haven't sufficient money. That's what we heard from you the last time that you were before this committee. So does that cause you to reprioritize some of those projects? In the case of Cayuga, I did just check, and it is five lanes in each direction. So okay, that would be a significant expansion, and thus a fairly expensive project, I would assume. So what I'm wondering about is, given your work, do you look at some of these big projects and say, for whatever reason, we've got to rethink where they are on the list?
Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Houseman, I think in the case of the two you've cited, both Cayuga and Stillwater are part of the Chapter 152 projects that were identified for replacement. And we have projected with the transportation funds and the bonding that is allowed, we will have funds available to replace Cayuga and Stillwater in the years that they were set. There was also, though, money in that same transportation bill for our operating budget. And as you mentioned, some of the tasks we're taking, adding fracture critical inspectors, this doesn't come without cost, but there was funding in that bill for operating budget, which funds our positions. So that's the source that we're using to fund these positions. So given those funds, I don't think we need to trade off the replacement. Those funds, I don't think we need to trade off the replacement versus doing this inspection or maintenance that we're describing today. We are able to do those both, but yet it's still clear there are unmet needs out there for the system overall.
And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, I know that you feel strongly about this. We didn't mandate particular bridges. We did not list any bridges in the bill.
Representative Houseman, that's correct. Not individual bridges.
So some flexibility in terms of their own setting of priorities.
Right. Representative Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, if you've addressed this already, underwater inspection, have you changed the procedures on that? I think, if I remember right, the Lowry Bridge had some problems with underwater. Are you making that more frequent, or?
Okay. Mr. Dorgan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, the underwater inspections, the requirement is that they have a diver for those bridges where you cannot go out there and wade and probe along the bridge foundation. The requirement is to have a diver every 5 years go out and actually dive. And unfortunately, in the Mississippi, that still amounts to a lot of it groping around because you can't see down there. But the requirements remain the same. We have good records on most of our major river crossings, and the foundations should not be a problem, but nevertheless, we do inspect them underwater on that five-year cycle. In the case of Lowry, that is quite an older foundation. In fact, I think it's, if I recall right, I think that may be from the previous bridge. So that one, there was movement on Lowry, and that's eventually on that pier, and that's eventually what caused Hennepin County to decide to close the bridge. And of course, the replacement is being designed, I think, right now.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you really haven't changed anything with underwater, then, you think that?
Not on the, Representative Earhart, not on the underwater side
of
the inspections. We haven't, I think we really haven't identified a need. Now, the movement at Lowry was known. That had been tracked for years, and underwater inspections were done at Lowry. So it was not an unknown or a surprise. It was just had reached a point from an engineering standpoint. It was determined that it was time to close it.
I hear Jesse's available. What? I hear Jesse's available. You may proceed,
Mr. Dorgan. And just a couple the last two slides. Just wanted to let you know, because I think this came up, at one of the hearings last year, as we discussed what we were learning from I-35, and I apologize, I can't remember if it came up at a Senate hearing or a House hearing or perhaps a joint hearing. Urging MnDOT to share our learnings with other states, and we're certainly doing that. We've participated in a number of national forums. We've addressed the 50 states, their bridge staff, on what we have learned to date from I-35 and the steps we're taking. And the process that we've developed, and because of the tragedy that Minnesota suffered, naturally, we're in the lead on this review of gusset plates. I mean, that's, I think, no surprise that we should be pursuing it more aggressively than anyone. So we're sharing the process that we're using with other states, and we've even posted it on our website as other states have asked for the information, the review process we go through. There's also national research on these same issues, and our design engineer is part of that effort. We continue to share our learnings and to learn from other states their best practices as part of roundtable discussions that we have with other Midwest states, and one of those is upcoming. The last slide, then, before I close, there's been quite a bit of discussion of bridge monitoring devices, and as you probably are aware, the new St. Anthony I-35 bridge has a bridge monitoring system installed in it. We also have on the Lakota Bridge that's under construction, the eastbound bridge, a monitoring system that is being added to that one under construction, so that work is ongoing. And I think one of the things that maybe got lost in some of the discussion in the media was the fact that monitoring systems are really not new for MnDOT. In fact, if we go back in the early 1990s, at various times we've had monitors on different bridges, mainly for either two reasons. One was, at times, research projects we were doing with the university. At other times, we had made a specific repair to a bridge, and so we monitored it before and after to confirm that the repairs were functioning as we planned. So we have been active in that area and continue to be. In fact, we've got an ongoing, the second to last bullet mentions the ongoing research the university is conducting for us to assess the available technologies on the market, and the upcoming projects that we're currently developing with them is to apply some of those technologies to an existing one of our older bridges. So this is an area where we're actively pursuing, and we just want to cover that as kind of, so you'd be aware of some of the new technologies we're looking into in addition to the equipment that I'd mentioned on one of the earlier slides. So with that, you know, I hope we've achieved our goal of trying to share what we've been doing in the last year in the areas of inspection. Welcome back, and it's good to see a lot of familiar faces, so we don't have to start from the beginning of bridges, and since you're all quite well informed. And with that, Duane and I would be happy to take any questions.
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have four kind of just quicker questions. I just didn't want to stop you as you were going through the presentation. And on slide 7, you talked about the fact that you've filled 3 of the engineering positions and that 3 are still open. And I'm wondering if you're having a difficulty filling those engineer positions.
Mr. Dorgan.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Portman. Yes, to be frank, we are. We've had to we've advertised. I think it's a combination of probably salary structure and also the type of work. A fracture critical inspector spends a good share of April to November. They're not out there with this weather today, probably, but a good share of the year, 1 week in, 1 week out. That doesn't appeal to some people. So we are continuing to try to fill those positions. We will get them filled. We're probably going to have to fill them with recent graduates. We would like to have registered engineers, some of the past applicants haven't had qualifications that we felt were suited for the job. So we're now looking at recent graduates that have an interest in that work, and we will need to have them in the positions, learn under a registered engineers, and train them until they become registered. So that answers your question, Representative.
Yep. And then on slide 13, I was wondering if the PB Americas report recommended a certain number of additional fracture critical bridge inspectors, or if they had just recommended additional fracture critical bridge inspectors. And I was wondering if there's any sort of a metric. You know, we talk about students per teacher in a classroom. Is there, you know, inspectors per bridge or the bridges per inspector metric?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman, I was just conferring with Duane since he's most familiar with that report. I guess they did not recommend a specific number, but the way we determined to add 8 positions was that we currently have between us and the district about 7, between 7 and 8 full-time equivalents doing fracture critical inspections. And with the changes in federal requirements that occurred about 2 years ago, it about doubles our workload. So that's why we're adding 8 more. So it was fairly simplistic, but we think that will be, we believe that's going to be adequate to take care of that workload. And in the meantime, until we can staff to that level and get all the people on board and trained, we are continuing to use consultants, but we'd like to get, particularly fracture critical, we prefer to do that with our own forces.
Just 2 more quick questions on slide 19. You were talking about, I think these were inspections that were done by other governmental entities, like maybe counties or cities. And you were saying there's a little bit of a delay between when they do the report and when it can finally get entered into the system. And my question there is, and one of the things you said got me thinking this way. You said, you know, they're out in the field, so they can't be putting this data in the system. I just wonder if there's a lack of administrative support for the inspectors that are doing the technical work, so that we can make sure that documentation loop is taken care of.
Mr. Hill?
I guess the best way to describe this is the people that we trained to do bridge inspections have the knowledge and background to also sit down at the computer and enter in the data. And if they don't do it and we have clerical support do it, they still got to check it before it's good data.
Right.
So traditionally, within our agency, it's not just counties and cities. Our inspectors do their bridge inspection work typically spring and in fall, and they either do construction inspection or bridge maintenance work during the summer construction season. And then typically in the past, what we've done is we've entered that data into our database. Once this time of year comes around, it starts to be too cold to be out doing that field work. So we need to make a pretty big change in the way that we've been our procedure and the way we're staffed in the past to get that done in a more timely manner.
And the reason I ask is because the idea that we wanted to have accurate information in the database as soon as possible, and same is true, and whether it's a campaign or a small business, you know, somebody can, the owner can be entering the data, but it's maybe not the most efficient use of that person's skills and time. Mm-hmm. And so if we need more administrative staff to get the data in so we can use it, maybe that's something we should look at. And then finally, the one big kind of what I thought was a point that wasn't covered was, are you changing the way you deal with bridge maintenance contractors in terms of providing advice about things that they do during significant maintenance projects on a bridge that relate to the bridge's structural integrity? Because I know when we had some earlier hearings, we talked about there's kind of the bridge inspection office and then there's maintenance, and they're kind of two silos that didn't necessarily intersect. And I wonder, in light of the 35W bridge, and I know we don't know what the reasons are, but that's a factor that maybe, are we going to be increasing communication between maintenance contractors and the folks with the technical expertise to know about load placement and things like that?
Mr. Dorgan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hortman. This is, I think this is something we mentioned last year. I think it was one of some of the documentation we did send over to the committee. I think what directly addresses the issue you're raising is construction loads on the bridge and how you sequence the work. We have changed our construction specifications, and in fact that's going out in all contracts this year, specifically putting restrictions on construction loads, requiring that if the loads would be higher than what we'd have for normal traffic loads, then the contractor is required to make a submission to the project engineer requesting to place those loads or that equipment on the bridge, and that is reviewed by a professional engineer. So we've changed that specification on construction loads, and that's, you know, admittedly it's directly related to what was on I-35, and this was a technical advisory also that Federal Highways put out in August of 07 on construction loads. So I'm not divulging anything that we haven't been public about in the past.
Just to follow up, and I hope that you'll think expansively about that, because in this situation it was a construction load issue, but you know, in the future there might be other expertise that the engineers who know about other technical aspects of a bridge could share with people who are doing maintenance work. And I just would encourage you to continue to think openly about that, because I would imagine if I ran a small company that did repair work on a bridge, I might not be cognizant of some issues that, if I had some sort of a dialogue with the people who are more informed, that could be helpful.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much, Mr. Dorgan and Mr. Hill. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and I think anytime. We appreciate the time to address the committee. Thank you.
And while we have the person from Public Safety come on, I'll officially call the meeting to order. We have a quorum, and I think you've had a chance to look at your minutes. Would someone move the minutes? Well, June 16th, Representative Housing did, or Representative Medora.
Would you give me the pleasure, please, Mr.
Right.
Chair?
Representative Medora moved the minutes. Everyone looked at them. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The minutes are approved. Oh, was there anyone else that wanted to testify while the department was here? I'm sorry.
That's kind of my job.
There was? No.
I don't, from the Department of Transportation, I do not believe so, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't know if there was someone in the audience that wanted to testify or comment. Apparently not. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Ms. McCormick. And Flavi, I'll let you identify what you're going to do. I could do it, but I think I'll let you identify it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I know that I was asked to provide you with an update on where we are with our project to redesign our information system. We have decided on a name for that project, and I think all of you have the handout that I provided you. We had a contest within the division to come up with a name, and so the name is MinLARS, and that stands for Minnesota Licensing and Registration System. We thought that would be easier right in the middle of pre-design of this system. As you know, that funding that was provided to DVS is being used to complete a pre-design of the project, and at the same time, the technology surcharge that was approved and enacted into law at the end of the legislative session, the $1.75 for driver's licenses, tab renewals, and titles is being collected. And the estimate at the time was the scope of our project is a project that will last for 4 years. And the estimate in terms of the cost is $48 million. And so the $1.75 was proposed because we believed we needed to collect about $1 million a month in that 48-month time period.
Mr. Chair, I'm having a really hard time between what's going on here and listening to Ms. McCormick.
Could we have... Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay.
Proceed, yeah.
All right, and so we have been, as I said, we've been collecting that technology surcharge fee since the beginning of July. We're right on target in terms of collecting approximately $1 million a month towards this project, and so as we're completing the pre-design and the planning of the project, we are building up the cash that we will need in order to work on the redesign of the project. So our pre-design has been underway for quite some time now, over the last year, and in pre-design project we're determining the appropriate staffing levels that we'll need in order to successfully complete the design. Obviously, we will be using experienced staff on the business side, and we'll be filling in behind some of those staff and then moving staff in and out as we're working on the business process changes that will be needed. And so we're in that process right now of getting that staffing completed. We also have been working on determining the high-level function requirements that we need in terms of doing our business process reengineering. We have been surveying other states and their motor vehicle agencies. There are several states right now that are going through the exact same process that we're going through. There's also several states that are in the final stages of completing their redesigning their information systems, and it's been very helpful to have discussions with administrators and other staff members that are working on their projects so that we can ensure that we're learning from the challenges that they may have had, and we're also ensuring that we're all communicating with each other, because as you know, many of the requirements that we have not only at state levels but at the federal level are similar across the states. We also have been looking at planning for the risk assessment and the mitigation strategies that are part of any technical project that's undertaken by a state agency, and so we're working on that. We're preparing
with the Department of Administration how we would go about with a request for information and a request for proposal process. And we're looking at prototype models for project governance, project management, and the methodologies we'll be using, and also developing transition plans as to how we will transition and finally retire our current information system at the end of in June of 2012. So it's quite a large project, as you can imagine, and also to be keeping our current processes in operation at the same time. But we feel very good about the progress that we're making. We'll officially kick off the MNLARS project in January of this coming year. And as I've listed on the handout, these are the various things that we're working on in order to ensure that we're being successful. I'm glad to answer any other questions that you may have or concerns.
Representative Holmberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. McCormick. With your standards, are you going to make sure that there's an audit trail of all access to the system? So in other words, if we have a bad actor in your department or law enforcement or whatever, we can track who had access to what information. And in addition to that, will you require a source code or when somebody accesses that information, will you delineate their purpose, their lawful purpose, or inquiry why it's being made as well?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, obviously that establishing an audit trail on all access to our information system is a top priority for DVS, and that is part of the process that we're looking at and planning on that being included. I do want to reassure the committee, though, that we are doing audits right now and are checking on those things as well. And we certainly want to build this in, though, as you're talking about, so that we can know that very quickly and be able to establish it. Right now, we have to do a lot of things in a much more manual process, but we are doing those things. But yes, that would be that data security and also the encryption of the data is at the top of our priority list in terms of a new system.
And if I might just add, for me, accountability is really important as well, and that people that have access to this information actually have the authority to have access to it. And I'm curious, a lot of work was done around the cybers database for law enforcement with all kinds of standards to protect individuals' rights, et cetera. So number one, have you consulted with the people that put together the RFP for that system, number one? And number two, what role is iPad playing in this process as well?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, well, we are consulting with the BCA on the identification and authentication of the users. So we have been doing that already. In terms of iPad, we consult them on a regular basis as necessary, but Department of Administration is part of our group of stakeholders and are also involved in a steering committee that's overseeing this project. So we will be continuing that consultation as we're going forward in the planning as well as the implementation.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hollisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this has nothing to do with the issue that came up last year, the customer use of credit cards. That's a totally other issue you're working on?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, yes, it's totally different in the sense that we need to report back to you in February, and we've been holding working group meetings with a group from Department of finance and also the Department of and also the county's various county associations and our deputy registrars are all part of this working group that we have. And we are planning, right now we've had about 3 meetings. We're meeting tomorrow again, and at tomorrow's meeting we will be discussing a our last meeting. We talked directly to representatives from MasterCard and Visa, which are the 2 major credit card holders. MasterCard is very willing to work with states and sounds like they have good relationships with DMVs and other states. Visa is not interested as such in looking at the same type of proposal that MasterCard has, which would be to allow a customer to pay a convenience fee if they wanted to use a credit card on that transaction, which is the way we're looking at it, because otherwise we would have to increase our fees to be able to absorb the costs, and they're quite significant, especially as you're talking about motor vehicle transactions. With the registration taxes and sales taxes. And so what happened within the discussion with Visa was that I asked if they would be at least willing to consider a proposal by us to serve as a pilot. And he wouldn't commit to it, but he did say if we presented him with a proposal, they would review it. So tomorrow's meeting is for us to finalize a proposal that we would then submit to Visa to see if they will consider us being able to use use their credit card, allow our customers to use those credit cards and then pay the convenience fee. And we've had quite significant discussions as well with U.S. Bank, which is the state bank at this time, in terms of how this might work. Which, if they would be able to provide the services, would mean it would require an amendment to the state's current contract to the state bank versus having to go through an entire RFP process. So we're in the midst of those discussions. I don't see our system. We would certainly have to ensure that we have the flexibility in a new system to be able to handle credit cards. I think the charge from the legislature and the governor in the bill was that we needed to come back with a proposal for consideration. That's our intent to do it, so it's not tied directly to this project. But obviously, we have to have the flexibility in any new system to be able to allow for electronic payments as we move forward.
Just always confused me, Mr. Chair, how the DNR is able to do it and not the Department of Public Safety. I'm totally bewildered by that.
Ms. McCormick?
I mean, you don't have to get into it, but it's just been something that...
Well, this, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, that when the last credit card study was done, the DNR was part of that discussion, and the issue is that the payments and any payments involving credit cards were wrapped up into their electronic payment processing system. And so those were taken on at the start of the system when they built their electronic payment system, processing system. And obviously that wasn't the case. Our system was in the 1980s, and that wasn't, credit cards were not the standard that was basically used for, especially for large transactions. The costs of large transactions, the DNR's costs are not the same size as the types of costs we can be talking about when we're talking about motor vehicle transactions, which could be over $1,000. So does that help you in that discussion? Because that's basically how it was done in the DNR.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. McCormick, thank you for your work on this. I have a question. You probably already know what it is. How does this relate to the Real ID program? And you know, I know that there was a grant that was applied for, and everyone knows that they're probably thinking we put this to sleep last year, but no. What thoughts do you have about that? I mean, is this going to be related to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, obviously there is an executive order that the department's complying with, which is not to implement the Real ID Act, but at the same time, I know all of you and the governor and our department want to ensure the security of our driver's license, and so the language in that executive order talks about us and being able to enhance the security of our driver's license, and I know that was also how the committee was responding about that issue as well. And so there was a grant that we had already applied for by the time that legislation came through, and that grant I think that the department had requested about a little over $1 million, and the amount that was awarded to the department was under $700,000, $690,000, something right around there. That grant proposal then went before the LAC for review in terms of whether we could accept that funding. And they decided that they did approve our accepting of the funding. The language, though, in terms of our acceptance, was changed at the federal level because there were several states that would have difficulty accepting that funding if it had anything to do with us being mandated to implement the Real ID Act. And so what it says in the language of the acceptance by the state is that we need to move forward in terms of enhancing driver's license security as the Real ID requirements state or something like that. It's very nebulous language, and if you would like, I can get you the actual language of that grant proposal, but it doesn't require the states to say they're going to be implementing Real ID. But at the same time, just in terms of the federal mandates that we have right now and in terms of the ability to really enhance security and to ensure that we're authenticating individuals that are applying for our driver's licenses, we do have to have the ability to be able to electronically message to provide that these people are who they say they are. And the federal law regarding commercial driver's license is very specific about the fact that we have to do that, as well as the National Driver Registry, which we're required to check to do, not to get any private information. We have to check to make sure that person has a valid license if they're coming in from another state. So there are requirements that still require us to do that electronic messaging, and so that's very important for us to do as part of this project. But it certainly isn't to implement, the purpose of this project is to just be able to allow us to be able to interact securely through encrypted messaging to be able to ensure that we are authenticating individuals. We also are going to need it to be able to comply with the NMVITIS project, the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System, which now is being required by, I think, June of this next year. All states have to be complying with that, and that's to enforce vehicle safety and to allow law enforcement to have more information about vehicles and the possibility of cloning of vehicles, as well as to help our consumers so that they know the status of that vehicle when they're buying it, whether it's salvaged or branded in some way. So there's a lot of requirements that at the federal level that require us to be able to have that kind of flexibility to message without real ID.
Mr. Chu, no, thank you. I really appreciated that explanation. And you know, just to be clear, I don't think any of us who were concerned about the Real ID program felt that we shouldn't have secure licenses, and you know, certainly support these enhancements. But I mean, that's very different than Real ID, and I hope we can, you know, continue to move forward. I mean, there's a new administration, so there may be some additional changes to that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Representative Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the two-year in process, is that because you're phasing this in, or why does it take 3 years to do what you're setting out to do here?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, well, because of the size of our system and all the different programs that we operate, it's very important that we believe that we need to do it in chunks versus trying to do it all at one time. And any of the states that we've talked to that have completed or are about to complete one of these believes that that's the way to do it. It's too important to try then to try to do it, you know, in one fell swoop and then flip the switch. And the other big problem is because we have the system is, you know, from the 80s. We also have a massive job to do in data cleanup to ensure that we're not just bringing that the data that we're moving from one system to the next, we're ensuring that's accurate data and that it's meeting our needs. And we're having certain, as I mentioned, Representative Holberg and her the response to her, that we're ensuring that we have authentication of the users as well as of our drivers and of the vehicle owners. And so those are a lot of the things, because we're going to be integrating the motor vehicle and the driver's license data into one system, which we think will be very helpful for all of our public safety partners as well as the court systems and other people that use our data on a daily basis.
Thank you.
Any further questions? No, thank you, Ms.
Okay,
McCormick.
Thank you.
And for all the members, we have a couple members that are not going to be with us, I think, unless we have another meeting this year. So it's nice to have you, Representative Madore and Representative Earhart. I think that's it, isn't it? Oh, Representative Ruth. So it was nice to have you with the committee. Appreciate it. And it's contributing a lot. I think it'd be nice to have you back, but I guess we won't have it. So unless there are any further questions, everyone signed their papers that they needed. The meeting's adjourned.
Yeah.